The date is Monday, September 19th, 1960. And we're in Laramie, Wyoming, having a visit with Mr. William Carlisle. Mr. Carlisle made history in Wyoming in earlier years. He led a very active and interesting life during those years, and no doubt his life has been interesting in the later years. I wondered, Mr. Carlisle, if I'll hold it.
All right. No, I can hold.
Okay. If you have ever been asked to appear on what's your line, for instance, that panel.
No.
That would be a wonderful thing, and they couldn't get who you are. I don't see how they could.
Well, I understand that someone wrote into them once. Now, I'm not sure which one of those programs it was, what's my line, or I've got a secret, something like that. But in a case like this, I found out through experience there wouldn't be no use of me going back there just for one program. The expense would be too bad.
Wouldn't they stand all the expense?
Well, they, as a rule, they will. They'll give you something, but you have to practically sign in lots of cases. Now, like on the We the People program, you sign your life away to get on it.
You couldn't do that. And, I think it would certainly be to their advantage to. This would be so unusual. I don't see how a panel could ever figure out.
Well, I believe that in a case like this, where if a man could make six or seven appearances back there on different programs, say within a space of 2 weeks, why then it would pay to do something like that.
Have you continued your copyright that you had?
Well, the copyright hasn't expired yet.
Oh, well, I wouldn't let it expire.
No, I was figuring on rewriting the book.
Oh, rewriting it or republishing?
Oh, yes. No, rewriting.
Well, why would you improve?
Well, there's at the time the book was printed, there was a bookbinder's strike, and there was a paper shortage. All those things combined to cut out some stuff in order to get the book out reasonably. See, they had to cut out a few things. And it limited to 220 some pages. But there could have been more in my way, and what I found out from my contacts with RKO and the Eagle Lion Studio out in California, now it's out of business, the Eagle Lions is. But they, you got to have everything just right, see. You can't make no.
You've got to be able to substantiate what you say.
Yeah. And this book is bonded.
Oh.
So that the names that's used in there, while we had permission for most of the names, what is in the book in reference to names was also in the newspapers.
Oh, yes.
Which made it newspaper copy.
There'll be no comeback on you then,
no.
That way. Mm-hmm. I know so many of these people that you speak of in your book, the Hessians.
Yeah.
And the Smith, Mrs. Al Smith.
She still has a hotel at Buffalo?
Yes, but she's married again.
I understand that.
Her name now is Bowman.
Bowman.
And Al's two boys are there. That's Bob and Al.
They're down at the ranch in the Crazy Woman.
Crazy Woman, and they're in business there, in cattle business. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, when you rewrite the book, it in a way, it will offset the previous...
story.
You know, it will offset the previous copyright.
Oh, will it?
But we have a release. I had a copyright. The copyright was supposed to have been in my name and the publisher's name also.
Uh-huh.
But we have a release from the publisher's widow. He died.
Oh.
So we have a release to do whatever we want to with the book because they didn't want to bring it out again.
Well, did you have a co-author in writing this book?
No.
You didn't?
No, sir.
Well, it's well written.
The only thing that's changed in the book, I wrote it, and then the secretary to the The publisher was at that time the assistant to president of the Richfield Oil Company, Rio Grande.
Oh.
He handled all our advertising accounts, and his secretary edited the book for me.
Now, this book, we
have... Oh, no, I'm not capable of writing a book like that. Uh-huh. That is, to phrase it properly.
Uh-huh.
See? Punctuation.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the book now. We'll say what the book is. It's Bill Carlisle. Do you say Carlisle or Carlisle?
Carlisle.
Carlisle.
Yeah.
A Lone Bandit, an autobiography.
Well, the autobiography was a misname because it isn't... Or it would take six or seven books like that to make a real autobiography of a fellow's life that anyone you know that roamed from Canada down to Mexico.
Sure.
Couldn't begin to get it in 220 pages.
Well, I think you're a rather remarkable man yet, Mr. Carlisle. You walk erect and stand erect. You're 70 years old and your hair is white and... you evidently recovered pretty well from these... battles you had with...
Well, just bear in mind now that the old saying, the outdoor life is best.
Oh, yeah.
And I've practically lived outdoors, except the 20 years at Rollins, which...
You were indoors then, huh?
I was necessarily indoors there. But living outdoors, you know, and I don't drink. I quit smoking in 23, never was a heavy smoker. So everything was all in my favor to recover from these things.
Yeah, now, this shot that you got through the chest and through the lung, did your lung, would that have to be removed, or do you...
Oh, no, the lung collapsed, and they operated and put two tubes inside from the side here, one down the front and one down the back.
Oh, yeah.
And they were in there for 13 months. They gradually cut them off, you know, as they work out, as the lung builds up. The only effect that I have on that is that sometimes I don't want to talk.
Oh, that's tired just to talk?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I hope that doesn't strike you now.
It's just temporarily. It doesn't last long, but there are times, you know, when it gets me that...
In this high altitude, here at Laramie, it's something over 7,000.
Well, I've always been in this high altitude, mostly in Montana and this state.
In
the northern part of Colorado, never has affected me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the only time I was in lower altitudes after I was 16 years old was when I was down in New Mexico, Texas, down on the border.
You've been kind of a lone wolf all through the years till you married.
Well, most of the time, yes. Once in a while, I'd run into someone that we knew each other.
Uh-huh.
But I'd always break away. I never stayed with them any length of time.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that three of your holdups of the Union Pacific took place in 1916.
1916.
And the next one in 1919.
In 1919.
And that was after you had escaped from the...
Yes.
And I don't see how you could build a box 6 feet one that you could cramp yourself into it without attracting attention.
Well, it's... now, that's a story in itself.
I know. You made the slats inside so you could handle them and manipulate them inside.
At that time, the guards were mostly very poorly paid. The
poor guard
surveillance over there wasn't very strict. And practically a man could, with any ambition, with any foresight, could easily figure his way out of there, which quite a few of them did later, after I did. But I'd recalled in figuring how to leave there without... any fights with anybody, you know. He'd get guns in if I wanted them, but I didn't want guns.
You never did kill anybody.
No, and that's in all my holdups, no one was ever shot.
Mm-hmm.
But to figure this out, I recalled I got a position up in the library. I was up there 18 months. Then I was in the outside office 18 months. And then I was it was 18 months up at the prison farm.
Oh, yeah.
But while in 1919, I decided I was going to leave, and I was working in the shop office then. And And I'd recall when I was a little kid, I'd read a story of a fellow that got sentenced up to Sing Sing. Unlike me, he was innocent. And he had to break out. So he'd had some experience in the library, and he notified the warden that the books in the library could be saved if they had them rebound. Mm-hmm. So the warden called him out, and he explained to the warden how these bookbinding companies in New York City would do it on a contract. Mm-hmm. And they'd send boxes for them to ship the books to New York. Mm-hmm. And that is for the different sized books, you know, they'd send different sized boxes. Well, they had a lot of those congressional record books, which are pretty big. So the warden gave him a job in the library, and he kept sending for these boxes, and naturally these bookbinders do a good job. So the warden was pleased with his work. So then he requested a long box that would hold this congressional library books. And those boxes was about 5 foot long. He was just a little fellow. So when one of the boxes come, why, he just shipped himself in that box and went out of there. Well, I remembered that, see. So working in the shirt factory, I had charge of all the outgoing freight. I made out the charge sheets, the bill of ladings. But we had one particular box there that was a little over 4 foot high and about 34, 36 inches wide. And then the depth of it was just two bolts of cloth. See, they could put in the whole box, you could have two rows of ordinary bolts of cloth, 30, 36 inches long, or wide rather, you know. Mm-hmm. And I figured that I could take one of those boxes. That's what they'd take those boxes and ship shirts back out in. So I figured I could take one of those boxes, could ship myself out in one of them. So I measured them down. I figured how many shirts could be packed in the bottom of the box, and then I put the cleats in there, and then boards, see. And the cleats held the boards down on top of that pile of shirts. Then I measured down from the top of the box, done the same thing. So then I broke in from the side, the narrow side of the box, I broke in the side of that, and I found out that I could just, by doubling myself up, I had space enough to rest in there, and I figured I wouldn't have to be in there over 2 hours at the most. So I figured I could stand that, whether it was on my head, my knees, or what it was. Well, when the day come that I decided I'd go, why, I had one of those boxes all fixed up. Now, I had educated the truck driver who hauled the freight down to the depot to take boxes without me being there. And I told him, I said, now on the last box that's to ship this day, I said, you'll find a bill of lading under the strap band that they put around all the boxes, see. And you'll know then that that's the last box to go. Well, on this day, I was in that last box. So, see, that's how I was able to go out there without anybody knowing anything about it.
How long were you in there?
Well, they put me into this was about 4:15 in the afternoon. I guess it was about 3:30 Saturday afternoon when I climbed into the box. It was about 4:15 when they got me down at the depot, and instead of putting me in the box car, they left me lay on the platform. Well, all the trucks going by there, freighters, people coming down to pick up freight or leave freight, I couldn't get out of the box. And at 5:00 when they closed up the freight house, well, they rolled me into the freight house instead of into a box car. So that made it easier for me to get out of it. And when I heard everybody leave, you know, the 5:00 whistle would blow, I crawled out of the box and went outside, went through the side door of the freight house. And of course, it was getting dark then. You see, this was on the 15th of November. And it was in the winter. So I just cut up through the railroad yards and took off west.
And didn't you go to a sheep camp and get the herders clothes?
Oh yeah, the next day I got snow blind that night. There was quite a bit of snow on the ground.
Right.
The moonlight. Mm-hmm. And towards morning I couldn't hardly see anything. I couldn't even see where there at Daly's the freights there climb a grade, and I could walk alongside of it, but I couldn't even see the handles climb on board it.
Where was it?
This was west of Rollins.
West of Rollins.
Out between Rollins and Wormsutter.
Oh yeah.
And the next morning, they walked down the tracks there from Creston. And towards noon, the posses had been notified that I was seen there at Creston. So they come out, and I watched the posses. It was a dirt road those days. See, this was in 1919. And they stuck to the dirt road leading to Wamsutter. And they searched all the sheep camps that was along that highway. But there was one back in the hills where I could see from where I lay. I could just see the top of the cabin in the sheep wagon in the draw. And when they didn't go back there, well, that's where I headed for, and that's where I got a change of clothes and a 25-35 rifle.
Was the herder there?
They came in later.
Oh, didn't they?
Yeah.
But they suspected who it was.
Oh, yes, they suspected who it was, but they didn't say anything, and I just told them I was going to borrow his rifle, that he'd probably get it back.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, he never did get it back. Yeah. The railroad authorities kept it, the special agents.
Right.
And that rifle now is in the UP Museum at Omaha.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that so? Did you ever know Dr. Heath at Rollins? Doctor?
No, I didn't.
You've heard about
that. Oh, yes, I've heard about her. But I didn't know
her. I have a recording from her.
Doc Barber was
Amos
the one that I knew there.
Yeah, well, he was...
No, that was Raymond.
Huh?
That was Raymond. Dr. Raymond Barber was a doctor in Rollins in 1920s.
Oh, well...
No, this other barber you're talking about. He was acting governor
during
the 90s.
Invasion of Johnson County by the stock guard.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Did you you weren't in the penitentiary at Rollins when you were later than Butch Cassidy?
Well, you see, Butch Cassidy, in his day, the penitentiary was here at Laramie.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yes.
Was it?
The old penitentiary building is used now as a stock over here at the Stock Farm, University Stock Farm on the west side.
Is that so?
The main building is still standing.
Wow.
And they use it for different purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The barred windows are there, the iron doors.
Well,
you ought to go over and see it. It's interesting.
I'd like to...
Yeah, that was the old territorial penitentiary. You see, the penitentiary didn't move to Rollins till about 1903.
Oh, yeah.
From here.
You didn't know Butch Cassidy. He was earlier.
Oh, no, I didn't get out here till 1906.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's a half a dozen years ahead of my time, and about 1903, I believe, or long in there, was about the last he was ever seen here in Wyoming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Along 1902. Now, I'm not sure of the dates. Could have been... 1901, but it's along in that time, and because... Tom Horn came after Butch Cassidy, you know.
Did you ever run on Tom Horn?
Oh, no. That was 3 years before my time.
That's right. He was hung in 1903.
Yeah, but when I came out here, why, everybody was still talking about it. And some for, some against, as they still are today.
Sure. Did you ever know Joe LaForge?
No, I don't believe I ever met him.
You knew of him?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I just wondered if he was ever in...
No, I believe he was over in Nebraska in my time. I don't think he got over here at all.
Mm-hmm. He worked for the stockgoers.
Yeah.
Detective. He's supposed to have gotten the goods on Tom Horn.
Well, he did get the goods on him. There's no doubt about that. But in my opinion, now, of course, there's a lot of talk. In fact, we had... a book by Dean Crackle up here tried to show that Tom Horn was innocent.
Yeah, well, I bet.
But Dean Crackle, myself, and Joe, T. Joe Cahill, and a few of the Westerners had a dinner out here at the Roundup Cafe, and they talked that over, and T. Joe assured him that Tom Horn was guilty. You know, because T. Joe knew him better than anybody.
Sure.
And he talked with T. Joe.
Yeah, he talked to him when he was
on
the gallows.
And on top of that, I don't know why anyone, now even in my case, now if I was to try to say that I was innocent of any of the things that I've been found guilty of, now why should anyone go to the trouble to try to prove that I was innocent after I'd admitted it?
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Sure.
There's no grounds for argument. I don't believe in Tom
Yeah,
Wall's
well, now,
case.
What prompted you? You didn't have any malicious
No, it's just merely
you
a
You didn't
case
want to kill
of,
anybody. You had lots of friends among the settlers?
Well, I always made friends, but I had a way of doing that. But as a kid, see, I was on my own all the time. And I was out more for fun than anything else. And I guess from an early time, I was peddling papers when I was 8 years old. I ran away when I was 12, and I kept running away until I was 15, and then run away for good. But my aim in life was to get all the fun out of life I could. Now, it wasn't a question, see, of right or wrong. If you want to put it that way, I'd say it's more like this. The question was that I absolutely had no regards for the rights of others, nor the respects of the rights of others. See what I mean? I wasn't brought up that way.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I found out while I was a little kid that if I wanted something, the easiest way to get it and the quickest way for me to get it was to take it.
Uh-huh.
Now, it wasn't that there was anything malicious about it.
Uh-huh.
And a woman could handle me easy. Among special friends, amongst the men. As a news carrier, I got acquainted with a lot of people, you know. And I was this way. I bought my own papers. I delivered to my own customers and collected from my own customers. Well, some of them I wouldn't even collect from at all unless there happened to be a good show come to town, you know. We had the 10, 20, and 30-cent shows those days. And if I couldn't carry bills to get in free, well, I'd go to one of these customers that I delivered papers to, and like Gary Porter was a cigar man there, had a little cigar factory and cigar store in Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I'd go up to him and I'd say, Gary, this is a show in town tonight. Lend me two bits and I'll pay it back to you. I'll deliver papers to you. That's the only way I ever collected from him. There was a doctor. There was a banker. The same way. The only way I ever collected from him is if I wanted money to go someplace, well, go to a show or something, I'd go to him and I'd say, lend me two bits, lend me four bits. Easy to pick up something little someplace. I think from what I've read in the papers, our juvenile problem is really increasing, but I still think that there's a lot of those kids that haven't been taught to respect the rights of other people.
The fact that you said that a woman could handle you easy, and the fact that you went to these pioneer homes and could receive courteous treatment, you get your meals and a place to sleep and so forth and so on, is evidence that you conducted yourself properly when you went to those homes because you had the confidence of the men as well as women.
Well, you see, it's like this. When we'd, most cowboys were drifters, what they call drifters these days, you know, they, when I'd go to town, give them a pay, well, when I went broke, if maybe someone say, well, let's go down south or let's go west, we'd go hunt a new job. Well, one of the last things that I'd do when in town, I'd hold out $3 or $4 and I'd buy candy and fruit. I'd take it with me, come to some homesteaders, you know, with little kids. Now, they wouldn't collect any. In those days, people wouldn't ask you for the price of a meal if you stayed there. They was glad to have you, glad to talk to you. Well, I'd always leave candy and fruit, you know, and that'd come down through Montana into Wyoming, some parts of Colorado. Well, people never forget it. I never did drink, so I was never abusive, you know, like some fellas would get. And if a man says no, I'd rather you didn't stay here. Well, I just gave him a smile and move on. That's all there was to it.
So, yeah.
Sure, the next time I come along, chances are I'd be welcome.
You, when you had that bullet in your wrist, and you traveled, according to your book, about 150 miles on foot, with infection set in and that.
Well, I had that bullet in that hand for 2 weeks, and I was unable to get medical attention of any kind for it. I had the idea after I left Medicine Bow, the rather the morning after the holdup there, when I got shot, the bone was broken in the back of the hand here, between the wrist and the knuckle here. And everybody that I come in contact with, and myself, we thought that was the bullet, you know, bulged up there. See, I knocked this fellow's gun up, and his gun went off, and the bullet tore in between the fingers and through the palm. So naturally, it was a small gun. We just thought that was a bullet, you know, broken the bone and bulged up there. Well, if I could get something to deaden the pain, I could cut it out. But unfortunately, the ranches where I was known, or where I'd be peacefully received, they didn't have anything. Of course, most ranches in those days done their own work on their own horses, you know. There wasn't a veterinary to show up right off the reel. So we had to let that go, and it was a good thing I did, because later, 2 weeks later, when I got shot through the lungs and eventually was taken back to Rollins, they operated there 6 months later, and the bullet had went on, that was a broken bone, and the bullet had went on up and split the wrist bone and lodged there, and you can see where they operated to take the bullet out.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now there's about a 3/4 inch of bone cut out here. That broken bone was cut out altogether.
Does the hand bother you now?
Well, yes. I bowl with it.
Oh, yeah.
But I had to, in taking up bowling right after the war, why, I had to bowl left-handed for 3 years.
Now, during that 2 weeks, you were a foot most of that
time? Yeah, I was a foot most of the time. And that was the last 2 weeks in November.
Bad weather.
And it was bad weather, and of course we was up there at a much higher altitude than we are here. I was up on the slopes of Laramie Peak.
Oh, is that?
And the hand did get infected, but by where I was safe to stay, or where I felt safe to stay, why, I kept it soaked in hot water.
And that
for maybe a couple hours at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that checked the infection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then, while you were in that condition, you were shot through the chest.
Yeah, I was shot through the chest. That was about the second or third of December, as long as first part of December, the first couple of days.
And they shot you with your hands up
I couldn't raise this hand any higher than probably the shoulder, because this arm by that time was all swollen from the infection.
And you were...
And I couldn't hardly, it was all I could do to bend the elbow.
Yeah. Was that fella Gale one of those fellas?
Yeah, John Gale was there. Charlie Irwin was there. McClements, all three of the UP Railroad.
And you could have killed two of those.
Well, yes. The night before, I had the drop on them. I was figuring if they followed me any further, I'd let them go on past where I was. And then to keep the posse back down at the ranch where I'd stayed that afternoon, I'd drop in behind them, you know, and just, it was snowing. And I'd just drop behind them, and they'd make them go on up the hill ahead of me, which would give me a chance to get away. But they stopped. They decided it was too dangerous to follow anyone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Mrs. Bray, she wrote an article about that. They followed my trail the next day.
Yeah, she told them that you could have killed them.
They saw the imprint of my rifle in the snow over this boulder, see where I had the drop on them.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, the snow was falling then. It was falling so fast that it was really getting thick, and I could barely see the top of the roof from the side of the hill where I was, mm-hmm. or the house where I'd stayed at that afternoon, and still I was less than 300 foot away from it. And they couldn't see anything. They couldn't see any length, any distance at all. And especially that hill really was covered with a lot of rocks. If a man wanted to kill anybody, he could really kill them before they could even get sight of him.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't my intentions.
Mm-hmm. These two fellows, was it Skelton and Montana and Mizzou?
That was in 1906.
Was that their real name? Or?
Yeah, that was the names that they went by. The Skeltons, they were quarter breeds, half breeds, part Indians.
And Mizzou. That
but this old Mizzou, people have asked me about him repeatedly. As far as I know, no one ever heard from him again, unless it was some people back up in northern Montana. But that's the last I ever heard of him, and from the one report that I did get, he was seen in Denver, so they knew he left there. He left the country alive.
He was a friend of yours, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was an old fella. He must have been right. He was way in his 50s. He had to be in his 50s because he could tell you a lot of things that had happened up around Alder Gulch in Montana in the gold age.
Is that?
I used to enjoy listening to his stories, and this was in 1960, and that was in 1863. So he had to be up there around in his 60s somewhere, but just like me now, he carried his age. A lot of people don't believe I'm anywhere near 70.
Yeah. Well, after what you've gone
and he
through...
He was just a little fellow, too, a short fellow.
There used to be a Mizzou Hines in that Casper country, and I just wondered if it was the same fellow.
Well, I doubt it, unless he really was. In 1906, now he'd have to be close to 60 to experience the things he always said he did, and everybody agreed that he was up there in the gold rush days.
It wouldn't be the same.
Oh, no, I've had a lot of people. I've even had editors ask me about the piece that I've got in there where he told me, he says, grab leather, kid. Says, the man ain't living that hasn't been thrilled. Well, the editors always claimed that fit everybody in the world as far as that goes because he says even businessmen get thrilled.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, that was his own remarks. It wasn't mine. And, of course, I didn't know enough about a horse, you know.
One place here you talk about the Dane and his five children, and all day and most of the night we rode the wagon loaded with supplies. Was that from Miles City?
Yeah, that was from Miles City.
You went to work
there? And his place was above Ashland.
Oh, yes. Well, did you know the house, the Captain House, the Quarter Circle... Circle Bar Ranch?
No.
There, the
Dunning? No, you see, that's the only time I was in there.
Oh.
It was just that short time that I worked for this Dane. And then when I walked out of there, I went over to Bernie and caught the stage down to Sheridan.
Oh, yeah.
So you see, I didn't have a chance to get acquainted with anybody.
And you speak of being in Oscar Nelson's saloon there.
Oh, yeah, old Oscar was a swell fellow those days, and... I've always felt a high regard for him.
His widow is still living.
That's what I understand.
Her name now is Canoodle, Louis Canoodle. He was a meat market man, butcher, but he's just dying now with cancer. I talked to him as Canoodle a few days ago.
Well, you see, in those days, back in 1906, 1907, a lot of the saloon keepers were pretty well thought of for this reason. I like Oscar Nelson. The sheep herders, cow punchers come in there with frozen feet, no money. He'd sort of take care of them. He had a couple benches, you know, back in the back of the bar, at the back end of the room, and fellas could sleep there. He's helped many a fellow. Mm-hmm. In fact, you could get help from him quicker than you could get it from a preacher or any other organization, because they'd always refer you, you know, to the county doctor. Now, I went in there, my hands were exposed, the fingers was raw, the bones stuck out of the ends of my fingers and my toes.
Is that so?
And I rode in at the sheriff on the stage from Bernie, but I walked from the Danes over in Otter Creek over to Bernie.
Well, is that where you froze your feet and hands?
Broke through the ice there a couple of times.
Yeah.
Got my feet wet and feeding stuff, you know, he had a little selfish feeding. But anyhow, going into Sheridan that way, now Oscar Nelson called a doctor for me, and I had a brother there then, and I soon located him. He happened to be working on the railroad at that time. Now I went to the hospital there, and my feet was operated on. They cut off the ends of the bone of the big toes, which leaves them slightly deformed. They granulated the flesh over my fingers. Now, of course, we had a personal doctor. See, we had a private physician. Now, at the same time that I was in the hospital, A kid was sent up there on the county. His fingers wasn't near as froze near as bad as I thought mine was, and yet they cut three of his fingers off. Mm-hmm. See, they didn't take no patience with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason Oscar Nelson was well-liked and well-known.
Mm-hmm. Did you know the Stiles brothers?
I've heard of them.
Yes, man.
Eatons.
Eatons, yeah. They were the dew ranchers.
But I didn't stay around Sheridan because as soon as I got out of the hospital, I didn't know what moment someone might find out where I was, you know, and come down out of Montana after me. So as I could walk, well, I didn't know that they wanted me or not. The fact of it was that they could have wanted me, see. And being a little bit leery that way, I decided I'd better get out of Sheridan as quick as I could because I'd already run into several fellas there that I knew up in Montana. And I told my brother one evening I was leaving. Didn't tell anyone where I was going or anything. I headed out. The next morning, I walked here over to Buffalo. In fact, I walked past your post office that night, Bighorn.
You did.
Followed the old stage route. The horse-drawn stage was operating yet. Yeah, I was in Buffalo the next morning.
And then you went on from there to...
And I went on over to this little place there that was called Klondike.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I walked over that way first so that if anyone did follow me, they'd follow me towards the mountains, figuring that I'd follow the east slope of the mountain south. And when I got out there to where I figured it was safe, why, that was around Klondike, the old Klondike Ranch post office. And then I cut straight across country, and that way, you know, I could avoid all ranches and everything else. And no one saw me till I hit into the Smith Brothers Ranch way down on the Craving Room. On the crazy woman, they're craving.
And he put you to cooking.
Well, couldn't do anything else. And with those frozen feet, he decided he'd make a cookout on me. I don't think he was very successful, but I know one day he told me they had everything ready for dinner. And he says about 9 o'clock, put it on the stove, and he said, you know, in those days now, they'd buy by the wagon loads from Montgomery Ward. And they'd go into Claremont, come by freight, you know, to Claremont, and then they'd haul it out to the ranch from there. So he told me there was a sack of rice in the storeroom. And he said, you go in there and get about a half a kettle, less than a half a kettle full of rice, and put it on the stove. And he says, it'll be done by the time we come in for dinner. So I did that, and... by the time dinner come, I'd started with about a half of a kettle full of what I thought was rice. And by the time dinner time come, I had pretty near 2 kettlefuls. Well, it wasn't quite done, and I put the beef stew and stuff on the table. I'd made biscuits and had everything on the table, and they ate. And towards the end, Al asked me, he says, well, Paddle, he says, where's that rice at? Oh, I says, I got a lot of it back there. Wait, I says, I'll go get you a dish. So I took a great big bowl there and went back and filled it up and put it on the table. And they looked at it, and he says, you call that rice? Well, I says, that's what you told me to cook. He says, you damn fool. He says, that's hominy. He kind of give up on me for being a cook from then on. No, I worked for Al and George 3 different times.
You know, they were among the so-called rustlers up there.
Well, yeah, their old John R. was, yeah. And I guess George and Al more or less, but they were, I found them pretty decent.
Oh,
of course,
sure. Yeah.
Being in what I was, you know, I found them pretty nice
sure.
To get along
yeah,
with.
Yeah, well, they were good fellas. They were reputable they, men there and died reputable men.
Al always had a bunch out there, you know, Grub and Greasewood. And he took the bunch out there one day, and of course they'd get out there, as cold as it was, they'd get out there and just grub enough to make a pile to hide them from the ranch house, you know, and then they'd build a fire and sit around and chew the rag, play cards or something. He'd come out there and caught them one day. So the next day he went up with them, and he says, now when you fellas grub this much off, he says, that's all you have to grub for today. Now bear in mind, that's what he said, see, that's all you have to grub today. So they grubbed it all off and piled her up and sat down, was playing Al, playing cards, and Al and George rode up and looked at us. And, well, he says, boy, he says, you done a pretty good job. He says, you done that pretty quick. He says, come on now. And he says, we'll hitch up the team. You can haul rock the rest of the day. Now, that's the kind of fellas he was, see?
Sure.
They were good-natured.
Sure.
Of course, they did have the reputation at that time of having three crews.
Yeah, you know this.
One coming, one going, and one on the job.
Yeah. There's a fellow lives up there, you probably didn't know him. His name is Manette, Walt Manette. And he came to that country in the early day, and he ranched down there. He worked for that Union Beef Cattle Company for a good many years, and then he finally took up a ranch down on Little Powder River and ranched for years there and accumulated quite a lot of land and a good ranch out there. And he finally retired and is living in Sheridan now. He's about 86 years old and his health isn't good at all. But he went with the CY wagon, Bob Devine, you heard.
Yeah, that was from over. They run up from the Cheyenne River country. That was their range.
Yeah, that was the carry out.
In that triangle, see, between Casper and Gillette, Casper, Newcastle. Yeah, I've heard quite a bit of the CY.
Yeah,
that was out of, they were out of Casper.
Mm-hmm.
And but they used that range quite a bit.
Well, he took a wagon in there one time, and he had written to these fellas in the home.
Yeah, that was right after the Johnson County affair.
Well, it was about that time.
Yeah.
And Walt went in there with the Ogallala. The two wagons went in, two wagon crews.
But I think that was Al and George's uncle that had charge of that outfit that time. That divided.
No, Al got his, Joe LaFleur shot a gun out of his hand. Shot him through the wrist in that deal, and Bob Smith was killed. Now, he married, either he married Al Smith's sister, or Al Smith married his sister, but they weren't related.
Well, Al Smith married she was principal of schools there in Buffalo, I think.
Oh, that was
teacher.
Margaret. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
That was Bill Hayes married one, and Al Smith married the other.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know what they
Oh, I've met them. I've met them repeatedly.
They were brothers-in-law, this Bob Smith who was killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Bob, but he rode into the ranch. They shot him off right outside the gate there. I've heard Al tell the story of that.
Mm-hmm.
They chased him clear up to the Trading Woman Ranch and shot him there as he got off to open the gate. He didn't shoot a gun out of his hand.
Was that Al Smith?
No.
Bob Smith was in the kill, yeah, but he
the brother-in-law.
The story is that he shot Al Smith, shot a gun out of
Al. I never heard Al say that. Never heard anyone mention it.
And then Elmer Brock, you knew of Elmer Brock.
Yeah, I knew Elmer Brock.
Yeah, well, I have his recording, and he said that Al Smith came by their house that night, and that his mother, Mrs. Brock, dressed Al's hand on his way in the Buffalo.
Well, could be. Mm-hmm. I never heard that story, but there's a lot of stories up there they didn't talk about very
That's
often,
right.
You know.
That's right. This would be a state meeting of the Wyoming Historical Society in Buffalo the 24th and 25th of this month. You
this month?
To come up.
Mm-hmm. No, I won't be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tied up for this month, and then next month I'm going to make a talk to the Littleton Historical Society in Colorado.
Littleton, Colorado.
Yeah.
Is that so?
That'll be on the 19th of October.
Oh, yeah. Say, would you be available to give a talk before our association sometime in Sheridan County? Of course, we would make it worth your while. And,
well, now, wait a minute. Now, here, get this right. Now, when I make these talks, I don't make no charge.
Mm-hmm.
See,
mm-hmm.
I do accept expenses,
mm-hmm.
where I can't leave here and be back the same night, you know.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Where I can do that, why, I just, if they want to give something, they can give something to a local charity in their community, like it was down at Fort Collins and like it was over at Torrington. But what I'm willing to make these talks just for the actual expenses, and then I do have a pet charity of my own. And if people want to donate a couple dollars to it, they can.
What is
and that's the Indian school at Ashland.
Ashland, Montana?
Yeah.
Is that so? Ashland, Montana. Hmm. That's where the Dunnings were. Yeah.
Well, the school was at Lane Deer. As I recall, the reason I'm interested now, this year was the first time that I heard from these people at the Indian school. But as I'm interested in Ashland for this reason. That's where I was before I went up to this Dane's place, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I did make some friends there, and as I look back at it now, there could have been the turning point in my life. I had the choice of going one way or the other.
Excellent.
Right there at Ashland, there was a dance there that night.
Mm.
And of course, it happened, I just took the wrong trail down the wrong side of the fence.
Who were those people you knew there, their names?
Well, the Warners, you know, had the ranch further down towards Brandenburg, between Ashland and Brandenburg.
Did you know the Brewsters or Booker Lacey?
I probably met some of those people at the dances, either at Brandenburg there at the old schoolhouse or at Ashland. That's too far back, and I wasn't interested in anyone else. All I was interested in was making sure that I wasn't being picked up. So names didn't mean much to me those days.
Indian school at Ashland,
Montana. Yeah, there's the address.
Indian school. Did you ever hear Nick Yoke Jones, F.R. Sinclair, St. LaBey, Indian school?
Yeah. See, there was a posse out after me. And there were some Indians camped up on the river. That's the Tongue River. See, above Brandenburg. And in order to keep out of sight, I run into that Indian camp. And there was some old log houses. Now, I don't recall just where it was. All I know, it was at night, you know. And there was some people out looking for me, all right. And I crawled into one of these houses, and a couple of the Indians must have heard me. I was afoot. But anyhow, they come over there to see who went in there. And I heard them coming. Now, there was nothing secret about it or anything like that. And they come over there, and they looked at me, and they could talk decent English, American. And they asked me what I was doing in there, and I told them I just crawled in there to go to sleep. And I stayed there that night, and they never said anything, and I left early in the morning, so I've always been favorable to those two Indians. And I do know their condition. I rode across there later on. I rode across through Rosebud over into the Bighorn Custer battlefield. I knew the country they had to live in, the conditions they lived in. And then, of course, I saw so much of it down in New Mexico, you know, in Arizona. I've always felt sympathetic about it, but that's the reason, I suppose, that I have kind of feel favored towards this Indian school at Ashland nowadays. Because as I look back on it, I can see perfectly well aware that I have my choice right there.
Now, you see, the first edition, how many did you print?
They run about 6,000 in the first edition.
And what did they sell for?
They sold for $7 and $4.
And
the deluxe edition, the serially numbered, sold for $7.
And they all sold?
They all sold.
And then the second edition?
Then I brought out 2,000 copies, and they sold for $3.
And they're all gone?
They're all gone. Oh, and they've been gone for 6 years.
They're out of print.
Yeah, they're out of print altogether.
I've got a library.
And it's like I told you, the Jimmy Walters here in the Connor Hotel gift shop got a hold of 8 copies last year, and he sold them for $8.50 to these summer teachers. Come in here to summer school? And when you can sell those people a book for $8.50, why,
who did he have published then?
They were the last of the second printing.
I see. Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know how many copies was produced altogether, but when I produced those 2,000 copies, they must have printed more, because at this time, they only had 75 copies out there in California from the first edition. And 3 years later, they were still selling them to bookstores.
Did you have these published at your own expense?
These 2,000 that I brought east, I brought 1,700 east with me. Yes, I paid for that.
What do you remember what they cost you per copy?
Oh, they cost me around, if I'm not mistaken, they cost around $2,900 for the 2,000 copies, which nowadays would be excessive if you can bring out 5,000 copies for around 89 cents a copy. Oh, yeah. The more you print, you see. The plates are good for, these plates of ours were supposed to have been good for 100,000.
Well, that's
100,000 copies. See? Now, we haven't printed anywhere. We've only printed about 1/10 of 100,000. Now, I don't know how many more they published, but they surely must have printed some more besides my 2,000. Or 5 years later, 4 years later, they still wouldn't be selling them to bookstores. And I tried to place some in a bookstore in Rollins, and they told me they just got some from Pasadena.
Can they do that legally?
Oh, I suppose.
Not legally, but it's done.
But you don't know whether this copyright is in your name and this publisher.
The copyright is supposed to be in the publisher's name, H.E. Britzman, and my name, W.L. Carlisle.
Well, where would you find out about that now?
Well, the only thing I know of is to have some copyright expert in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Trace it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I thought if I could bring out this booklet, it would be about the size of, not as thick, but about the size of the old American magazine, or Liberty, something like that, you know, but they'd have the story in there and a few things that isn't in the book. And I honestly believe that here in this state alone, in the course of 2 years, we could sell around 10,000 to 15,000 copies.
I believe you could. I believe it'd be very popular. The Western fiction is popular now, but Western authentic history should think, more popular.
Well, you see, one drawback about my book, I learned that on the trip to Hollywood. They had me at the Eagle Lines. Aubrey Skink had me there twice. And I talked with Harry Sherman in the Enterprise. He had me at his place twice. There's no romance in the book.
That's what it takes. That's what I told him.
Yeah.
Well, the nearest thing, we set that off.
Now you're talking about the...
We were talking about no romance in the book. And unfortunately, when I was a newsboy, there was two of us boys, was very friendly, we was considered buddies, and we delivered the early morning paper. And that was, we'd have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, deliver the paper, the hometown paper, before breakfast. And then I'd meet the 7 o'clock train, and I'd get the Philadelphia, New York papers, which I peddled on my own. And for that reason, I always had money. My father never took any of the money that we earned away from any of us children. And there was 5 of us before we started running away. And we all eventually run away from home. Well, anyhow, my buddy and his sister come down and they got me. And that day, my father wanted to take me to a circus. And I'd already been that afternoon. But that evening, I told my father no, I didn't want to go. And later, this buddy of mine, his sister, come down, and they told me that they was going to go to the show. Of course, they wanted me to go because I could get the tickets. And they said they had a girlfriend of the sister, And the four of us would go, so I went. And we went up to this girl's house, we picked her up, and then we walked about 8 blocks to the circus lot, and we went to the circus. But after the circus was over, they always had what they called an after show. I don't know if you know the term or not, but there was a little show that they'd put on after the main circus was over. While they was tearing down the tents, they'd put on this little show. They charged extra for that. So I bought tickets for that, and after that was over, why, this girl wouldn't walk home with me. She says, no. She says, what do I want to walk home with him for? So for that reason, I think I always had it against girls. Mm-hmm. And I never did. I was never known to travel with the same girl to a dance more than once or twice. But I also had another reason for that. As I got older, came out to this country, I always begin to be leery. You know, that someone sooner or later was going to tap me on the shoulder and say, I want you, kid. And I didn't want to be caught with a decent girl when that happened. So you see, there's no possible chance for a romance in my book.
Miss Carlisle, about the... Well, I did ask you how many books, but I noticed in your book, in reading your book, you weren't very high on the stock of this man, Hadsel, was it?
He was the warden.
He was warden at Rollins. We were mutually agreed. We had no use for each other. It was mutual, see, it wasn't one-sided. And, in fact, some of the guards warned me several times that he was going to get me one way or the other. Well, he was a strong friend of Bill Jeffries. And I was still, even after I went over the road, I was still one of those flip guys, you know, always making remarks. But I always had the, always had a knack of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. And but usually I kept my word, like when I wrote to the newspapers that in order for them to get the men out of jail that they had arrested for the train robbery out of Cheyenne, I'd hold up a train west of Laramie. Well, they always said I was a braggart. But usually if I said anything like that, I always lived up to it. I always kept that promise. Hadsel was a big friend of Bill Jeffries, the manager of the railroad at that time, who later became president.
He's manager of the Union Pacific.
Yeah, in 1919. He later became vice president and then president.
Yeah.
And, of course, Bill Jeffries, he always said that I was never going to get out. And I told him once before, just the summer before I made the escape, he told me I was right where they wanted me, and they was going to see to it that they kept me there. Well, I told him, I said, Bill, I said, don't be sure of it. I said, I might leave here someday and get another train, which I did the following November. But you see, people called me flippant, you know. Said I was always bragging or something like, well, I wasn't. It's just merely that I'd say the first thing that come to my mind, you know, without thinking about it. If I'd have stopped to think, I'd have never made some of those foolish remarks.
This is
a Kleber
Hadsel.
That's the son of, He's at Rollins now. Yeah, they were sheepmen then.
Were they?
Yeah. But back in the 20s, you know, the old man had, Frank, he had the ranch up there, and Kleber, I think, was just going to school here at the university then. Of course, all we know in those days, you know, the old man, then no one ever thought of the son. And speaking of a rancher, you always spoke to the old man, and of course, Frank being alive yet, why, he was the head of everything out there. But he became warden there, and one thing led to another, and he jumped me one day for something he had no call to jump me for, because it happened a long time before he was made warden. And I told him so. Well, that didn't set well with him. He was sort of a bullheaded guy. Now, when he said something, he wanted you to listen. See, you had no right to talk back at anything. But there's one thing I've always said about Frank Hadsel.
in one way. He was one of the best wardens he ever had up there. He believed in the boys being out in the yard in the fresh air every chance they got. And he was strong for sports. He saw to it that they got out there to play baseball. He'd even take 20-year men downtown to the Elks Club when they put on fights down there. So in that respect, I consider he was always one of the best wardens that was ever at Rollins during my time, and they had about four of them. But nevertheless, we were mutually agreed we had no respect for each other.
Now, I don't know whether we got started just right on this. I think we just started talking. Where were you born? Of course, your book tells that.
Well, I was born in Chester, Pennsylvania, May the 4th, 1890.
Oh, say, there's a thing I wanted to talk to you about. Did you know Charlie Flory?
I've known several Florys.
Well,
now, I'm not sure.
I used to wolf up there in the old dead country, and he lives up there, and I have a recording, and he says he knows.
Well, I believe
Charlie.
I do.
And I asked him, I said, where did you know him? He said, we were kids together in Pennsylvania.
And no, he didn't know me then.
Well, now, what I thought was, he killed his daddy-in-law.
Yeah.
And he served time in the penitentiary, and I thought maybe that is what he knew.
That's where I'd have known him if I'd known him. I knew him over in the pen. But he didn't know me in Pennsylvania because my mother died when I was 9 months old. And then I was put in three or four different relatives at different times decided they'd try to raise me. In the end, I ended up in the orphanage in York, Pennsylvania. And I left there when I was 7 and a half in 1897. Uh-huh. See? So you see, he couldn't have known me in Pennsylvania.
Well, I just had an idea that, what's this wrestler's name that used to be up there in Johnson County? He said that you came to see him one time out at the OW.
Well, that's probably right.
But no, he worked at the OW in 1904.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. Like, he's probably hanging around there later.
Oh, sure. He's there yet. He's up in that country yet.
Yeah, he probably met me there.
He served time in the penitentiary. I just thought to myself, and I told some others that that's probably where it was, rather than being boys together in Pennsylvania. Well, it's certainly been interesting talking to you, Mr. Carlisle.
Well, I get all kinds of calls, and back in the 20s when Hadsell was warden, there's people come up from Colorado and picked me out and identified me as a boy having went to school at Sterling and Greeley. And I never was. The only time I was ever in Greeley was I stayed there at the Canfield Hotel. And that was just one day. Now, that's the longest I'd ever been in Greeley at any one time up to that time.
Well, did they bring
these people come up on their own.
Oh.
And there was a sister down there that claimed that I was her brother.
Oh, that's
And she come up with her husband and child, and that was during Hatzell's administration.
Oh.
And they called me out one day. Carrie was governor, and they called me out to the office. And wanted to know if I knew a girl, and they mentioned the name. Well, the name did sound familiar. And I told them now, I said, well, if I ever knew anyone with that name, it had to be up around Sheridan or Edgemont. And the result of it was that Governor Carey called up Hadsell and then talked with me on the telephone in the warden's office. And he wanted to know if I'd meet these people and talk with them. They was writing to him. They was claiming that I was their brother and they had the wrong man in the penitentiary. And I told them why, certainly. Well, that Sunday they were already in Rollins, down at the hotel there. So that afternoon they brought them up and they dressed me in civilian clothes and I sat between two guards and they no sooner come in that door than they identified me. They recognized me. They said they did. That is the way they looked at me, see? So the Hadsell talked with him, and he told him, well, now, he says, we know that Bill Carlisle was born back east, that he never went to school in Sterling or Greeley. Well, she says, you've got the wrong man in here. And Hatzel then told two of us, presumably I was a guard. See, dressed in civilian clothes. He says, go out and bring Bill Carlisle in. So I and a guard went out, and we brought in a man of my size, and we stood in the doorway, and Hatzel asked this lady, says, is that him? And she says, no. She says, that's him, and she pointed to me. Well, we had quite a bit of time straightening them out, see, that they were in no way related to me.
Were they just trying to release you?
No, they thought that they, she thought, and like I said, there'd been different farmers come up and identified me as a boy they knew.
Oh, yeah.
No, she was mistaken, honestly mistaken. And I've had even up to about 3 years ago, I used to belong to a traveling bowling league here, and we'd bowl down at Greeley and Fort Collins, Boulder, and I've had people come up to me. Well, I remember you. We went to school together over at Sterling. Oh, no, you just go ahead. No, those people can be honestly mistaken that way. No, I've been identified several times, and I've had people writing to me claim they were my cousins. Oh, I doubt whether as a month goes by, but what I get a letter from someone that claims they knew me or was related to me. I don't pay no attention to the letters. If I answered those letters, why, it would keep me busy, I'm afraid.
I suppose people come through here knowing of you, and
they look me up occasionally, yes. Well, I don't mind talking with people, but I don't want to write to people. They, if someone writes to you, claim you as a relation, and you answer their letter, they're going to write back. They'll find some reason for insisting that they were right and you're wrong. Well, I don't like to get into those kind of arguments, so I don't answer the letters.
What's that purpose in doing it?
I couldn't say. Put a couple of them away and never lend them out because I didn't know when there'd be another printing. That's one of the last things I done. See, that's the reason this library has them. Now, I happened to talk here a few years ago with a lady who said she worked in the library up there at Newcastle. And she said they stole their copies and she'd like to get another one. And she said that was one of the most frequently read book up in their library. That was up to 1955.
We were in Powell 2 days ago, and I went in the library there, and they didn't.
Well, I did give several of the northern counties copies. Children would come down here, you know, for the basketball tournament in the spring of the year, and they'd like to get a copy. Well, I made the school libraries several copies of the last that I had, but I haven't had any, you know, since 55. But I couldn't begin to keep libraries supplied with. I was, what surprised me, the book, as far as I know, was never sold east of the Mississippi River, the Missouri, east of Omaha, except at a little town of Findlay, Ohio. That's the only place that I know of that was ever on sale, and that was due to an oil man that knew part of the book. And 300-400 copies were sold at that little town of Findlay. But I was up in Rochester. My wife was operated on at Mayo's. This is quite a number of years ago. And to my surprise, there was a copy of the deluxe edition in the library. Supposedly given to it by me. It was autographed by me. But I don't recall. Well, when I was released, in regards to my wife, when I was released in May, or January the 8th, 1936, up to that time, for 19 years, I had available one of the best surgeons in the state. He was called to Omaha repeatedly for serious operations in the railroad hospital there.
Who was he?
Dr. Raymond Barber. But I was never sick, except for this being shot up and minor operations. I was never seriously sick there. When I got out that following May, I had a ruptured appendix. Well, I was on my own then. And they had to make a quick operation of it. And the result of it was a part of the appendix that was just cut, you know, it wasn't all taken out. My intestines was put back in such a way that raw cut was right against my spine. And it grew there, and I developed another appendix. A month later, they had to operate on me again for appendix. And my present wife, that is, I've only been married once, my wife was superintendent of the hospital there then. And she gave the antiseptics in both operations.
And that was at Rollins?
No, at Kemmerer, Wyoming.
Kemmerer.
Yeah. So that fall, we got very well acquainted, and then that December, we were married.
And that was in 36?
36. December the 23rd, just a couple days before Christmas, 1936. I came here in September of that year and went to work for Oscar Hammond. See, I'd opened up a cigar store over there. But after those two operations, I had to get out in the open, and I was broke anyhow. And I realized if I was going to regain my health, I'd have to get out in the open. And I went down to a family of the name of Davidson. I stayed at their ranch for 5 weeks. I bought a .22 rifle and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. And for a month, all I'd done was kill off the gophers. So I gradually recovered, and then I went up into Jackson Hole and saw Harry Weston. He was a banker there then. We were acquainted. And I come on over to Casper and down here, and I was offered a job here by Oscar Hammond, the University Filling Station. I went to work for him. That was September the 19th. And then I went up to Kemmerer in December and was married. And the following June, my wife moved down here. Later, we took over this cabin court out here, but she's a diabetic, and she became quite ill at different times. She injured her spine, or she thought she'd injured her spine, and we took her to specialist in Denver. We had her in the hospital 3 times there that year. We had her in the hospital here. We took her to chiropractors and osteopaths, and eventually we took her to Mayo's. Well, here everybody thought she had a slipped disc, which she did all right, but she also had an injured spine. She'd been in a car wreck years before that. But as she'd walked away and it didn't feel anything, she never thought she'd been injured in that car wreck. But Mayo's found a decayed spot in her spine, so they had to operate on her. And here, 4 years ago last April, I managed this... what is now known as the Roundup Motel. I owned that and operated for 19 years. And I was still, she was going to the hospital several times a year. We never owed a bill here that we didn't pay in that 19 years. But we decided to sell, and we sold out while we could pay off everything we owed, and we bought a home here. Then I went to work for Buck Harding. He's a sheep man out here, but he's a stock buyer, wool buyer, and he had 16 apartments out here, and I more or less managed that for him, but I took care of his long-distance stock deals for him. That's mainly what I was hired for, and I done that for 2 years until he died, and then his sister, Mrs. Dan Kirkbride of Meriden, Wyoming, they kept me on out there to operate the apartments for him. Until I went on Social Security last May. Now they have a Sergeant Lisbon and his wife out there running the place.
Did you ever know a doctor's center?
I've met a lot of those people from up there, but I don't, like I say, names never meant too much to me, and I've met quite a few of them coming down here for conventions and things or other at the university.
I had a visit with him. I have a recording from him. I had a visit with him a few days ago in Powell, and we were talking about him. And do you know a man, a guide in the Du Bois country named Daniel, isn't it? Is it Daniel?
Well, no, I can't say as to that because I haven't been up to Dubois for 10 years. And I knew Gene Amoretti up there, but he's dead. And Father Peyton and I went up to visit Gene one day from Lander.
Well, if you have anything to do, don't let us keep you.
Well, I have nothing. Today I don't have anything serious to do. I've already done the seriousness. I still, for the apartments out here, I still take the money and deposit it at the banks for the people that are running the place for them. Kind of overlook it for Mrs. Kirk Bryant until... Well, they're over at Meriden.
Yeah, that's probably them.
They have children, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, he was just over here just a couple weeks ago.
Kind of funny thing occurred to me. You talk about getting money from the apartment and depositing it. You don't have a border pass to have for it, do you?
Oh, no. They, we take in around... They also have 7 rental units over here and some houses that are being on sale. We handle about $2,400 a month, but I don't have any trouble collecting them. Is Mrs. Dan Kirkbride?
Yes.
She's in the Masonic Order. They was just up there to Sheridan this summer.
Yes, that's
she's a big Republican.
Sure.
Yeah. No, we very seldom have trouble with tenants, and operating the cabin court for 19 years, I think I understand families, you know, and if they can't pay promptly, why, we're not one of those outfits that say, well, pay or get out. And especially if they're sick, the Kirkbrides, the Hardings always have went along with them, you know, they never push people that way. So we're considered pretty decent landlords, yeah. Once in a while, we get a family in there that wrecks things, and of course, no one could get along with those kind of people. Yeah, that's right. Well, they, you said you'd like a little story, and I could give you one that was left out of the book. It's... Wherever I go, I usually wear a light-colored shirt or a mixed-colored shirt. I doubt whether if I have wore 3 white shirts in the last 40 years. In one sense of the word, I've become allergic to a white shirt. The reason of that is that this was before the train holdups. They had been down on the border. I was down there partly in 1910, partly in 11. One way or another, I was connected to the gun-running outfit, taking guns across the border to the revolutionists. And on my way back up north, well, I run into a fellow one day, and I'd been to a dance the night before at Bisbee. And in those days, we had what we called a white Japanese silk shirt. They were flimsy shirts, you know, but they were fancy. How they got the name of Japanese silk, I suppose they were silk, I don't know, but they didn't cost very much, you know, but they did make a good shirt, you know, to go to dance with. So I was wearing that shirt the next morning when I ran into a fellow that I knew, and he told me that they had something lined up and wanted to know if I'd be interested. Well, I said, if you can show me where we got a chance, why, I said, I'm interested in anything. So after we talked it over, well, I decided it was worth taking a chance on. We rode out of town, and the next day we met 3 other fellows. And the thing had already been set up. And according to this party that I knew, we wouldn't be bothered by the sheriff or the deputy. And as it happened, the sheriff was called out of town that day. It was just a little place down in Arizona. And he was called down into a ranch section. We rode in and took the bank, and we didn't get
Oh, we got less than a fourth of what they claimed was taken. And we got less than a fourth of what was supposed to have been in there. That when we rode out of town, why, we got out about 6-7 miles, and here was the deputy sheriff and another man waiting for us. They wanted their share. But unfortunately, the sheriff had got back into town some way or another shortly after the holdup. So he organized a posse, and he was on our trail when we wasn't looking for him, or this bunch wasn't looking for him for hours. And it was getting towards evening then, and in the fall of the year, you know, it gets dark pretty early, and especially in the timber country. So they caught up with us, and in fact, I never got a cent of that money. And we had to take off when we spotted the sheriff coming. They kept after us, and the darker it got, why, the bunch split up. And until at last, along about 8 o'clock, they were still on my trail, the fellow was with me. And the moon was up then, and every time I topped a hill, you could just hear those bullets humming around you. And it wasn't until, a half hour, it must have been close to 8:30 or 9 o'clock, that I began to realize that they was following me on account of that white shirt of mine showing up every time I topped a hill. Well, it didn't take me no time at all to tear that shirt off after that, and of course I lost them. Now, one thing about it in those days, when a fellow was going in for something like that, he didn't have a fancy horse like you see in the movies. But he did have a horse that could cover the ground and stay with it, a range-fed horse, you know. And you always had decent horses. You always had a good horse. If you didn't, you stole one that was good. So that's the only thing that helped me get away that time. But I got away once I tore that white shirt off. But I've been allergic to white shirts ever since. Well, 3 days later, the first time I got to see a paper, and that was up at Winslow. And I was surprised that they counted close to $8,000 that they got from the bank. But I was surprised reading the paper that we got better than $35,000.
But you didn't get any.
I never got a cent of it. No, they split up before they had a chance to divide it.
Sure.
No, they only one of them, but that was in Denver, and he just laughed about it.
Did he get some?
I guess he did. No, there's lots of humor in those things. They're not all serious.
Do those fellows sometimes up in on you?
No. The only time up at Rollins, I used to, on Christmas, I'd get a package from up in Montana from Great Falls. And, I knew it was from all right. Never mentioned no names.
Did you ever know Jim Ruffle personally?
No, I saw him twice.
Of course, his pictures are in those books.
Oh, yes, but and you see, the owner, Mr. Britchman, the publisher of the Trails End Publishing Company, he bought all of Charlie Russell's effects when Charlie died. He bought them from Charlie's widow. Bought the home and everything there in Pasadena. And he had the right to use those pictures. And that one picture, the sketch of a man sawing the bars of a window, was something, it's the only picture, it's the only sketch that Russell is supposed to have made that wasn't Western. And he'd done that for a friend once. It was to went into a magazine article. He'd done it for a friend, and then it was never used.
Well, did you know J.R. Williams?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I have visited his house several times there in the San Marino section of Pasadena.
Yeah, his cartoons
are
being run over.
Yeah, his cartoons.
I've had some of the good men who wrote in the practice.
Yes, I met him, and he wrote the article in the front of the book there, and at the time we brought the book out first in 46, Richmond had me come out there in February, and I had a very bad cold, and I stayed there for a week. And they had me, they deleted some of the book, and they had me write the range riding days. And I was there for a week, and I wrote that range riding section there in Richmond's home in Pasadena. And then Richmond gave it to Williams to read. And Williams told him, well, he says, you know now who wrote the book. No, a ghostwriter. I did give the manuscript to a party once that was supposed to have helped me, wanted to help me. And the book was sent east to Macmillan and Company, and we was a year getting it back. And then they had the book for, this was in 36 and 37. Then they had the book until 45 and hadn't done anything with it. So they still had my manuscript, and to my surprise, the copy that they got back from Macmillan, with the exceptions of the first few pages, was just the way I wrote it. They didn't correct it or anything. Of course, those publishing companies will edit it anyhow after they get it. And I made the remark then that I thought the reason that the book didn't go was because they hadn't corrected it any. Well, she says, I thought that this party had had it, said they thought that if it went in my words, it would go better. So then I took the manuscript back. That is, I kept my copy. I never did get the original manuscript back. And then I took it, and I went to Pasadena, and I wrote The Range Riding Days, and then it was published. Later on, I found out that I was supposed to have stolen the book.
What do you weigh ordinarily? What do you weigh now?
I weigh around 204 pounds. But in my riding days, I very seldom exceeded 168, and being a tall guy, I was always skinny. Yeah. When I worked for Alan George Smith up there, I weighed about 140 pounds. I didn't weigh enough to get a job as fireman on the railroad. But I still hadn't filled out, see, when I was 17.
They called you Paddlefoot.
Yeah, they called me Paddlefoot. Come in there afoot, you know, and I couldn't wear anything. I had to wear overshoes, frozen feet. So they called me Paddlefoot.
Well, you must have had a wonderful constitution.
Well, I can only refer back to what I said before. Living in the open is helpful.
You don't know whether to think of another story like the White Church, do you?
Well, I could think of 20 of them, but I think one of them is sufficient. Of course, we did. I believe I've got it in the book. I'm not sure. I did have originally. One of the times when they was hunting me out here for one of the train robberies out of Cheyenne, I happened to stop at a homesteader's house that evening at the rancher's house, and he was from Iowa.
Were you afoot?
Yeah, I was afoot, and I stopped there that evening. And now I don't know whether it was the son or the daughter. I think it was a son that went to Iowa and married a girl and come back with her. So the young couple was there and the older couple. And that evening after supper, he went out. He had to go a half mile, you know, to pick up the mail at the gate on the rural route. And when he come back, they had the Cheyenne papers, and here it was all about me. And the old lady says, oh, if he'd just come along here. And the first thing I know, they had that whole there was $5,000 reward on me then, which later was increased to $6,500. And before I knew it, they had the whole $6,500 spent if I just come by the house.
did they have a description of it?
It's in the paper, but it wasn't a very good, no, it wasn't a good description. But the things like that's full of humor, you know. And of course, I stayed there with them that night, slept there. Of course, I couldn't keep from laughing. They hadn't the least idea in the world that the man they was talking about was seated right in front of them. And they had no reason to suspicion anything like that. You see, when I first come out here, very few people was carrying guns except on the open range. And you would carry a gun there, you know, to shoot coyotes with. snakes or anything like that you wanted to shoot at. But a rancher would supply you with ammunition if you had your own gun to kill coyotes. But the first thing you done, if you went into a rancher's house to eat, you hung those guns up or you laid them outside. You never kept the guns on going into the house. So quite a few places, they remarked about it later on, just like the old days. Man come in, hang his guns up back of the stove. Well, then they're not going to suspicion anything of you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, they hadn't the least idea in the world. They had no reason to suspicion me. It happened at Cheyenne. I was way north of Cheyenne then. Oh, I could cover 45 miles a day.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. In rough country, I'd cover 30, 35 miles easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was pretty, like I said, lived outdoors. I was healthy and strong. If I wanted a horse, I had lots of ranches where I could have got a horse.
But then I'd put them on your tail.
Yeah.
No,
I wouldn't have to steal a horse. Oh, yes, I could have borrowed a horse, but the idea of it was they wasn't looking for anyone on foot. No one dreamed a man would hold up a train and then take off cross-country afoot.
And then you could hide from
them. Oh, sure. They, one thing about it, when they had so many posses out at looking for me, they had them out of Laramie here. I was up here in the... north of here, towards Laramie Peak country, I never missed a meal.
And you were amongst friends?
Well, I was not always amongst friends, but if I'd see a bunch of riders riding up through the country, I'd just lay low till they went past, and if they didn't drop at some particular ranch, why, that's the ranch I'd get down and get a meal. Posse was looking for me further north. Oh, it was considered a joke, you know. All the ranchers wasn't very favorable to the UP anyhow in those days, you know, the small ranchers in particular. If you wanted to ship stock, you was a small man, you'd go to the railroad and order a couple cars, and you'd drive your what beef you wanted to ship down there to the shipping pens. Well, they had to graze on whatever was around the shipping pen, maybe 2 or 3 days before your car showed up. But all during those 2 or 3 days, you'd see string after string of empty stock cars going west to some big outfit. So the small ranchers wasn't in sympathy with the railroad at all. Then, of course, there was no radio to speak of. They had the crystal sets lots of places, but there was no radio and very few telephones. And where there was a telephone, where there was a one-party line, you know, everybody was on the same line. When one telephone rang, why, pretty near every ranch along the line would pick up the receiver and listen in. We followed the posse that way for 2 days once. Some rancher would call up a friend of theirs, you know, and they'd say, well, a posse was just here looking for Bill Carlisle, and here we'd be listening in on it.
Well, that sure have been interesting, Mr. Carlisle, yeah. And I hope to, have you another little short story?
Well, I've got a little page here, yeah. Nothing.
You asked me a while ago that if I'd be available to make a talk. Well, I've made it a point, I used to do it pretty regular, that I'd talk before any civic organization. And I never make no charge, personal charge, you know. And I don't want to receive any benefit that way. If they paid my expenses, that was plenty. And then in case they wanted to, they could give to one of their own local boys groups. Some civic organization sponsored, you know, or Red Cross or something like that. And we did made quite a few talks that way. Of recent years, why, I've had arthritis, so I don't get around too much.
Well, Where's the arthritis?
In the right shoulder and the right hand and the elbow.
Is that the way? You think
yeah.
That's the result? That
well, it, it could be. No, we, it's age, you know, and then I didn't take sleeping out in the open so much in real cold weather, being exposed to cold. That's just a natural result, I believe.
And then having gone so long without medical attention and infection study, that was quite a little of them being shot through the lung on top of that.
Well, most of us, you know, do have a pet charity of some kind or another. Some people will give to the community chest where they won't give to something else.